Welcome to NTD Evening News. Our top story tonight, the Group of Seven summit kicks off in Italy. President Biden calling out China for supporting Russia as he signs a 10-year security pact with Ukraine. What it means for the U.S. and what's next as G7 leaders now agree to use frozen Russian assets to fund Ukraine. Iris Tau is there. Hezbollah and Israel continue to battle it out across Israel's northern border. Now, some Middle Eastern countries are expressing concerns about a possible war in Lebanon. Jason Perry has the war update. The Supreme Court today unanimously ruling to preserve the FDA's relaxed requirements for obtaining the abortion pill mifepristone. The court said the physicians and anti-abortion groups that brought the case were not the proper plaintiffs to challenge the revised rules. Arlene Richards has the details. A bill enshrining access to in vitro fertilization nationwide fails to pass in the Senate. Hear how Republicans and Democrats react to the bill. And former President Trump returns to the nation's capital for the first time since he held office. Luis Martinez speaks with lawmakers on Capitol Hill.
This is NTD Evening News. Live from our NTD global headquarters in New York City, here is Tiffany Meyer.
Good evening, and thank you for joining us tonight. President Biden announcing a 10-year security agreement with Ukraine as he calls out China for supporting Russia. It comes as G7 leaders come to an agreement on a new way to help Ukraine. NTD's Iris Tau has more from Biden's press conference in Italy.
And President Biden laying out three major steps to help Ukraine at a joint press conference with Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky right here in Apulia, Italy. First, he signed a 10-year security agreement with Ukraine, pledging America's long-term support for the country.
Not by sending American troops to fight in Ukraine, but by providing weapons and ammunition, expanding intelligence sharing, continuing to train brave Ukrainian troops.
Second, Biden said leaders at the G7 summit here have agreed to use frozen Russian assets to send a $50 billion loan to Ukraine to help it buy weapons and rebuild infrastructure.
We're not backing down.
A move that Zelensky called
fair and absolutely right.
Though Russia said it's criminal and warned of a painful response. And third, Biden highlights his administration's new actions on Wednesday, widening sanctions on Russia to stop China from helping Russia. The president calls out China for his role in the war.
China is not supplying weapons, but the ability to produce those weapons and the technology available to do it. So it is, in fact, helping Russia.
These three major steps, Biden says, shows the U.S. and G7 allies are standing for freedom and against tyranny. And as Biden amplifies his foreign policy on a global stage, he also answered a question about his family at home. He again vowed not to pardon his son, Hunter Biden, who's found guilty this week on gun charges.
I said I abide by the jury decision, and I will do that, and I will not pardon him.
And on Gaza, Biden says he's not expecting a ceasefire deal to come soon, but remains hopeful. Hamas, he says, is the one who is holding up a deal. Reporting from Apulia, Italy, Iris Tau, NTD News.
Hezbollah and Israel continue to battle it out across Israel's northern border. And now Iraq and Iran's foreign ministers are showing concerns about a possible war in Lebanon. NTD's Jason Perry has the war update.
On Thursday, Hezbollah terrorists fired approximately 40 projectiles toward northern Israel, with many of them causing fires after they landed. The Iran-backed terrorist group increased its attacks on Israel in recent days after Israeli forces killed the most senior Hezbollah commander since the war started. And on the same day, the Israel Defense Forces, or IDF, released a video said to show strikes on Hezbollah military structures. An Israeli government spokesperson addressed the situation.
Whether through diplomatic efforts or otherwise, Israel will restore security on our northern border. Lebanon and Hezbollah, under the guidance of Iran, bear full responsibility to the deterioration of the security situation in the north.
His words come as the IDF continues to train for a possible ground offensive into Lebanon. The foreign ministers of Iraq and Iran met on Thursday and talked about this very issue.
God forbid, if an attack occurs on Lebanon, then this will have an impact on the entire region.
Meanwhile, in Rafah, the IDF reported locating weapons and killing several terrorists in close quarters combat. Israel's recent ground offensive into the southern Gaza city is causing more residents there to move once again.
Everyday negotiations. Who are you lying to? Solve this for us. We are emotionally tired. They tell you to leave this place and go to the city of Khan Yunis, from the city of Khan Yunis to Rafah. We feel like we are like toys.
Also in the Gaza Strip, Israel recently released some prisoners who had been detained since around October 7th. People greeted them in the streets, and one of them complained about his time in detention.
We have left, but we call on you to get the rest out. There are detainees who are dying, suffering which you cannot imagine unless you experience it.
And the mother of a rescued Israeli-Russian hostage said her son was also abused while held captive by Hamas.
Andre told us, there are some things I will never tell you. I don't know what he didn't tell us and what he doesn't want to ever tell us.
There are still approximately 120 hostages who remain in the Gaza Strip, and negotiations for a ceasefire to release them appear to have stalled. Jason Perry, NTD News.
Russia is formally accusing jailed U.S. reporter Evan Gershkovich of spying. The U.S. State Department reacts today after Russia sends the case to court.
There is absolutely zero credibility to those charges. We have been clear from the start that Evan has done nothing wrong. He should never have been arrested in the first place. Journalism is not a crime.
The Wall Street Journal reporter has been detained in Moscow since March of 2023 when he was arrested and charged with spying. A Russian government official announced Thursday that they have determined Gershkovich collected secret defense and military information in Russia under instructions from the CIA. Gershkovich, his employer, and the U.S. government have denied the accusations. The Wall Street Journal spoke out in defense of Gershkovich, calling the case an assault on free press. Gershkovich is the first journalist to be arrested on such charges since the Cold War. The Supreme Court today unanimously rejecting a lawsuit challenging how the Food and Drug Administration regulates access to the abortion pill mifepristone. Our legal correspondent Arlene Richards has more.
Supreme Court justices on Thursday unanimously decided that the physicians and anti-abortion groups that sued the FDA did not have standing to challenge how a woman gets access to the abortion pill mifepristone. While the case is not directly about abortion, the court's ruling does preserve a woman's ability to easily access the drug. Access to mifepristone became a more important issue after the court overturned Roe v. Wade 2 years ago. The drug is also prescribed for miscarriage treatment. Justice Brett Kavanaugh, writing the opinion for the court, said the plaintiffs couldn't sue the FDA based on the rare chance that they may someday have to treat a woman who suffers complications after taking mifepristone. He wrote, because plaintiffs do not prescribe or use mifepristone, plaintiffs are unregulated parties who seek to challenge the FDA's regulation of others. In 2016, the FDA deemed the drug safe to terminate pregnancies up to 10 weeks. Previously, it was 7 weeks. The agency also reduced the number of times a woman had to present for an in-person doctor visit, from 3 visits down to 1. In 2021, they announced that women were no longer required to visit a doctor in person, allowing telehealth visits instead, and permitted women to order mifepristone through the mail. Both supporters and critics are reacting to the ruling. Katie Daniels, state policy director of Susan B. Anthony Pro-Life America, said in a statement, "The fight to stop dangerous mail-order abortion drugs is not over." She called the ruling a sad day for all who value women's health and unborn children's lives. Stella Dantis, president of the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists, said the decision provides us with long-awaited relief. She said the findings allow patients and doctors continued access to mifepristone for medication abortion and miscarriage management. Kavanaugh explained in the ruling that the plaintiffs had to actually suffer an injury in order to have standing to sue the FDA. He said the injury had to be traceable to the pill or the FDA's decision to loosen its rules. And by requiring the plaintiffs to have an injury, It screens out people who only have a general legal, moral, or policy objection. Arlene Richards, NTD News.
In the Senate today, Republicans blocked a bill that would have established a legal right to use in vitro fertilization, or IVF. The so-called Right to IVF Act, sponsored by Democrats, failed in a 48-47 vote. Senate Democrats slammed their Republican colleagues for not protecting what they called a women's right to IVF. Meanwhile, Senate Republicans said they support IVF but oppose the measure because they consider it a Democratic attempt at election year messaging. Republicans put forward their own bill to protect access to IVF nationwide. The move to enshrine access to IVF follows a February ruling from the Alabama Supreme Court. It ruled that human embryos created through the process are legally children under state law. Some IVF providers in the state suspended their services, fearing possible liability. Former President Trump holding separate meetings today with House and Senate Republicans in a bid to unite the party ahead of the 2024 elections. Our Washington correspondent Luis Martinez has the details.
House Republicans met with the former president at the Capitol Hill Club. The meeting lasted over an hour right after I spoke with Congressman Derek Van Orden, the Republican from Wisconsin, and I asked them what was the main message from today's meeting. Let's listen.
What was the main takeaway from this meeting?
Unity, Donald Trump working to maintain and grow the majority in the House, take the Senate and the White House, move forward collectively to have a country that is safe, secure, and prosperous. I was sitting there. I had to wipe my eyes because I was laughing so hard because people don't understand how incredibly humorous President Trump is.
I also spoke with House Freedom Caucus member Congressman Byron Donalds, the Republican from Florida, and he said that the former president had no policy demands from lawmakers.
Did President Trump mention anything about House GOP strategy towards the DOJ?
No. He just talked about what he talked about was just how ridiculous the DOJ is. They have been weaponized against them. That's just a fact. And, so he talked about it and expressed himself. I think any American in his shoes would feel the same way.
Former President Donald Trump also met with Senate Republicans at the National Republican Senatorial Committee right after he held a short press conference. This is what he said.
This was a great meeting. There's tremendous unity in the Republican Party. We want to see borders. We want to see strong military. We want to see money not wasted all over the world. We don't want to see Russian ships right off the coast of Florida, which is what they are right now. That's unthinkable. We want to see just success for our country.
It's important to note that despite the public differences in between Senator from Utah Mitt Romney and former President Donald Trump, Senator Romney did attend the Senate GOP meeting with the former president. Reporting from Washington, D.C., Luis Eduardo Martinez, NTD News.
Welcome back. I'm Tiffany Meyer. A blazed up the Rose fire is threatening Arizona. The town of Wickenburg is forced to evacuate, but residents can't take Highway 60. It's also shut down in both directions. According to the Arizona Department of Forestry and Fire Management, the fire has burned more than 200 acres and has not been contained. Six buildings have been burned and about 100 homes are at risk. Local authorities are advising residents to have an emergency bag prepared. And for the evacuation, those who live on the west side of U.S. 60 need to evacuate to the Wickenburg Community Center. And those who live on the east side of the highway need to evacuate to Morristown. A hearing today on anti-Semitism on college campuses. This comes in the wake of tumultuous pro-Palestine protests that swept across the nation's universities. NTD's Fiona Ji has more.
We can easily see that many universities are failing their students by turning a blind eye to anti-Semitism. Instead, they are caving to the demands of loud, hateful, and destructive detractors.
The House Ways and Means Committee hearing focused on the alleged discrimination and threats Jewish students have experienced on campuses. Much of the discussion focused on weak university leadership.
Blatant violations of Cornell's code of conduct continue, appeased and rewarded by my university.
The campus administration has to enforce its own rules. The code of conduct on its campus has to be updated.
Others pointed to university faculty who support pro-Palestinian students as another cause of the unrest.
We must hold accountable the faculty who openly support and celebrate terrorism.
The fact that faculty are supporting that in many cases, this is unprecedented and shouldn't be compared to prior protest activity.
Still others say that the hatred seen on college campuses reflects a problem far beyond a political issue.
The seeds of hate are sown long before the freshman year. They're sown at home by mothers and fathers, grandmas and grandpas, aunts and uncles and families. I am amazed that we think there's a political answer to a human problem.
There has been a sharp rise in reported anti-Semitic incidents since Hamas's October 7th attack on Israel. Despite quieting down, pro-Palestinian student protests still continue. Fiona G, NTD News.
In New York City, owners of unlicensed cannabis stores filed a lawsuit yesterday to challenge Mayor Eric Adams' crackdown on them. So why are there still so many illegal weed shops in states where the substance has been legalized? Earlier, we spoke with Ben Court, author of Weed Inc., The Truth About the Pot Lobby, and science advisor at Smart Approaches to Marijuana about the realities of marijuana policies. Ben Court, thank you so much for joining us. Great to have you back on the show.
Thanks again for having me.
Now, New York City is cracking down on illegal pot shops, with estimates that there are almost 3,000 illegal ones in the city. Now, to begin, why are there these illegal options when in states where it is legal? Why is this?
It's really quite simple. It's the fundamental issue we've always dealt with this is there is not enough enforcement. There's certainly not enough resources that have been dedicated to enforcing these things. So you can have every law in the world and every code written that they have to adhere to, but if there's no one holding folks' feet to the fire, then you'll continue to have these situations. It exists in every state.
And how should we understand the increase of these illegal shops, especially in states where it is legalized?
Well, it's a very complex issue, and there are some states that have tried to fix it. What it comes down to is that typically these things are regulated by a federal function. And since the feds won't pay any attention to this, it falls on the state, and the state doesn't really have infrastructure for this. So does this go to local county code enforcement officials? Does this go to local law enforcement? Do they need to build a whole new division to do this? And we've not seen any state put anywhere close to the resources it would take to really regulate and police this. They said, well, we want all the money, but we certainly don't want to spend any of that tax money to make sure that it is being responsibly administrated.
And given that, what has been the impact on communities, especially young people?
Well, I was in New York City 2 weeks ago, and you know, of course, I've read the news and I've seen everything. That was absolutely unbelievable, what I saw just walking around. I took some long, long walks when I was there. And the impact is, you are normalizing this vice substance in multiple different forms of consumption to a much younger and, of course, to a much more vulnerable group of people. These shops exist mostly in economically disenfranchised areas. These shops exist mostly right where your young people are walking around. This is very intentionally put together. I read a story about pop-up shops that are outside of high school campuses. It's having a significant impact. And I think part of what we're communicating to young people, we're saying to them, hey, this is safe, this is okay, because it's been sanctioned, if you will. But then since we're not actually enforcing any of the safety mechanisms we've put into place, we've made a social contract with America that we haven't even begun to fulfill our end of.
And what about the mental health aspect? Are there enough set up to deal with maybe the increase in cases following the use of THC, or what have we seen?
I don't know how to state this strongly enough, especially without sounding like some sort of silly pundit or whatever, but you just asked me if there was enough water in the ocean to fill up a cup. And The answer is the same with this. Do we have enough resources for mental health and for this? The answer is so far down the no spectrum that I don't think I can even appropriately quantify it by saying no. We don't have a fraction of what we need, yet we continue to recklessly rush forward with this, saying, give me the money, you guys all deal with the consequences of it.
And zooming out a bit, let's take a look at Thailand, which is reversing course. It used to legalize marijuana. That was supposed to help the country, but now it's actually planning on banning it again. What can we learn from what happened over there?
We could learn the same thing that we learned from Montana 30 years ago when they did this, from Alaska 30 years ago when they did this, from what I'm sure we'll see in Canada, from Amsterdam, for example, who's really cut theirs back, is that this doesn't work is a simple math problem where you say decriminalize and then allow retail and everything gets fixed. This works when people are really willing to dig into the details, like in Uruguay. And I think what you'll see here is, or what Thailand is showing us, is what we've seen so many times before. This is a really great and interesting idea on paper. Now put that into the reality of human nature, and it's an impossibility.
Ben Court, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
Updates on the plan to build a new city in California. It's now gained enough support to qualify for the November ballot. Billionaires are supporting the initiative to transform a rural part of California into a sustainable city. NTD's David Lam reports.
On Wednesday, the local Registrar of Voters projected that nearly 15,000 signatures would be valid out of the 13,000 required, making the California Forever plan qualified for the next steps. California Forever, founded by Silicon Valley entrepreneur Jan Schramek, says it manages over 60,000 acres of land in southeastern Solano County. The group wants to urbanize and build a new community with part of its land, saying that in the county's current state, the next generation of residents wouldn't be able to afford homes.
We are committed to the same degree of collaboration with our friends and neighbors here to build something really special here over the next 30 years.
Schramek wants to bring in 15,000 local jobs in the next 10 years. The jobs would pay more than $88,000 annually.
The number of people who said my 17-year-old son or daughter told me that if we build this, they would love to stay here and this is where they would like to live. Or the number of people who said, my 35-year-old daughter called me, who no longer lives in California, and said, Mom, if we build this place, I would like to come back home.
While the organization is transparent about their plans, residents and officials questioned the group when massive amounts of land were purchased anonymously previously. Skeptics questioned the group's initial quiet approach, especially with Travis U.S. Air Force Base just several miles away. The next step is for the county supervisors to either accept the results and adopt the plan, put it on the November ballot for voters to vote on, or require an impact report before putting it on the ballot. David Lam, NTD News.
Welcome back. If you're just joining us now, here are some today's top headlines. In a setback for pro-life activists, the Supreme Court rejected a lawsuit challenging access to the abortion pill mifepristone. The ruling means the drug can continue to be mailed to patients without an in-person doctor's visit. Former President Trump met with House and Senate Republicans on Capitol Hill in a bid to unite the party ahead of the general elections. He addressed his legal and electoral challenges and touted tremendous unity in the GOP. Tensions flared up between Israel and Hezbollah as the terrorist group launched some 40 rockets at northern Israel. This came as the foreign ministers of Iraq and Iran met to discuss the possibility of war in Lebanon. President Biden signed a 10-year security agreement with Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky to help the nation at war. The G7 also agreed to deliver Ukraine a $50 billion loan using frozen Russian assets. Earlier, we spoke with retired U.S. Air Force Brigadier General Robert Spalding about the latest loan to Ukraine. General Spalding also served as Senior Director for Strategic Planning on the White House National Security Council. General Spalding, thank you so much for joining us. Great to have you back on the show.
Thanks. Great to be back.
Now, President Biden is in Italy at the G7 summit, where they just signed a $50 billion deal to support Ukraine. What is your analysis of this deal?
It's the same as all the other fundings prior to it. There's no real goals or outcomes tied to it that I think is achievable in any time soon. I firmly suggest that we have armistice, ceasefire on the agenda for any, you know, for your future funding. Like, you know, if we don't tie it to some kind of achievable outcome where there's a cessation of hostilities, this is just going to continue to be just like the Korean War, quite frankly. And, you know, Korean War progressed very similarly. There was movement on both sides, and then finally it stalemated. And then finally we came to our senses and negotiated a ceasefire that's held. And I think this is the only thing that's really going to get us out of these repeated funding cycles between Ukraine and Russia. And that doesn't mean that we're going to stop supporting Ukraine. But what we could stop is these incredible losses of material and people every single day on the battlefield.
This comes as China is pushing a alternative Ukraine peace plan. This is according to 10 diplomats. Now, one calling this is a subtle boycott of the global meeting that is set to take place this weekend in Switzerland. 90 states and organizations have registered. Russia is not invited, and because of that, China is saying they are not going to attend. Russia has called this entire thing futile. What do you make of China's plan here?
Well, you can change the word China for Soviet Union. Essentially, they're playing the same role that the Soviet Union played in the first Cold War. And Russia just happens to be one of their proxies to include North Korea and Iran, a lot of other countries like Cuba, for example, where Russia is, you know, just is making a port call, I think, really, as we speak. So this is the second Cold War. That's how it's playing out. Those are the main players. China is leading all the rest to create an alternative to the free world. And unfortunately, the free world wants to have its cake and eat its too. It wants to continue to have global economic support and partnership with China, while at the same time complaining because China's supporting Russia. They're supporting, you know, things like Iran and Hamas, and of course creating trouble in their own backyard. So we have to understand what the situation is that we're in and really look with clear eyes at what the Chinese Communist Party is doing.
Switching gears a bit here, Saudi Arabia has decided not to renew the petrodollar agreement. This was signed in 1974, under which it sold oil exclusively in the U.S. dollar. Is this the end of the petrodollar? How significant is this?
I don't think so. You know, there's no currency that's going to replace the dollar. You know, Europeans are too divided to really have that kind of pull with the euro, and the yuan is never going to do it because the Chinese Communist Party is never going to allow the yuan to be freely convertible. So I think this is, you know, Saudi Arabia basically doing what Saudi Arabia thinks is in its own best interests. There again, I think in the Middle East, we're going to have a change if we do get a new administration, because hopefully we'll begin to stifle the Iranians again, like we were doing before. I think that needs to happen. And I think we need to restart the Abraham Accords. This can all be pointed to just really not thinking strategically about the region. And, you know, having Saudi Arabia drift further and further away from the United States is not good for either Saudi Arabia or the United States.
On that note, many have called, say, Trump's policies more isolationist. How do you see that fitting into something like the Middle East?
I think they're actually more realist, and we have to be very clear-eyed about, you know, the threat that is posed by a China that, you know, looks to be even more powerful than the Soviet Union was economically, and they're using that economic might to encourage, you know, other countries to be on their side in this ideological competition or conflict. It's a cold war, and I think unless we figure out that, you know, we have to treat this in terms of what is in America's best interests and not just go, you know, have a strategy based on more or less on talking points. And I think we're going to continue to have struggles. And we're going to continue to have things like the Russia-Ukraine conflict be an expense to the American taxpayer on an annual basis.
General Spaulding, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
One of the main issues on the G7 agenda is countering China's industrial policies, which member countries consider unfair. Also of concern is the Chinese regime's vital support to Russia. NTD's Washington correspondent Jack Bradley has more from the State Department.
World leaders are meeting in Italy for the G7 summit. They're united in opposing China's non-market business practices, as well as its ongoing support for Russia's war machine.
This comes as the U.S. Treasury Department on Wednesday announced new sanctions aimed at stopping countries like China from supplying Russia with materials used in the war against Ukraine. U.S. officials say that China is the leading supplier of Russia's weapons and a vital contributor to its economy. Here's State Department spokesperson Matthew Miller on these new sanctions against Chinese companies.
What's the impact of these sanctions? What do you hope these sanctions could do? And then is the Biden administration considering further action on this?
We are considering further actions. Our hope is that companies engaged in rearming Russia's defense industrial base and bolstering Russia's defense industrial base so it can rearm the Russian military, that other companies will see these actions and think twice. We have made clear our concerns to the Chinese government about the actions that Chinese companies have taken to help restock the Russian the Russian defense industrial base, and have made clear that those actions are unacceptable. And countries in Europe have made clear the same thing. And you saw the action taken by the G7 yesterday, including actions that the United States took, and we will not hesitate to take further actions as appropriate.
The G7 were also concerned over China's industrial overcapacity. It results from heavily subsidized products flooding the market. On this, the Biden administration is implementing a 100% tariff on Chinese electric vehicles. And the European Union will also slap a 38% tariff on Chinese EVs.
Beijing has been ramping up its support for Moscow, selling the country dual-use computer chips that are made using U.S. technology. Reporting from Washington, D.C., Jack Bradley, NTD News.
Examining how China is preparing for armed conflict, witnesses at a hearing today laid out what China is doing to potentially invade Taiwan and fight the U.S. NTD's international correspondent Arian Pazdar has the highlights.
Xi Jinping has exhorted the People's Liberation Army, party leaders, and the Chinese people to dare to struggle, a Maoist phrase that suggests preparing for conflict.
The U.S.-China Economic and Security Review Commission held a hearing on Thursday titled China's Stockpiling and Mobilization Measures for Competition and Conflict. Multiple witnesses said there are clear signs China is preparing for conflict. A commission member said China could invade Taiwan as soon as next year. One sign that China is about to invade could be preparations for its civilians.
They could have trainings on evacuations or how to take shelter or just first aid.
One witness said China is currently buying technologies that can give them an advantage over the U.S.
Cyber-related technology, quantum technologies, and of course drones, and not just drones, but underwater vehicles also, unmanned underwater vehicles.
But China also suffers from many weaknesses, one of which is that 80% of its military belongs to the one-child generation. They are now raising their kids while at the same time taking care of their parents.
The biggest vulnerability in our Taiwan contingency is the social mobilization of the PLA. It is extremely difficult for the government to convince the moms, the grandma, the grandpa this is a great idea.
Another one of China's disadvantages is that its military is much less experienced than America's.
One of the paradoxes of the relative, at least outward impression of order that we see from China is there's not the same level of that kind of testing. So we don't really know how things would go until it actually happens.
He added that the U.S. military might seem disorderly, but it has proven itself many times. Arian Pastar, NTD News.
And now an exciting announcement. NTD's original documentary, Hollywood Takeover, China's Control in the Film Industry, is coming to the big screen in New York City this Saturday. It will screen at the Manhattan Film Festival on June 15th at 1 p.m. Here's a preview. Is it really just about money? Are there other parts at stake?
Chinese influence was playing into what we see in U.S. films.
China said, you can't have that in there. And Hollywood listened. This is insane.
And we all know that their goal is global domination.
People have been brainwashed without knowing it.
That's this Saturday at 1 p.m. at the Manhattan Film Festival. Don't miss it. Use the link down below to get your tickets. Welcome back. I'm Tiffany Meyer. Missing security footage, accusations of treating unions like viruses. Some takeaways from today's Senate hearing on Boeing's workplace culture. Here's the story.
If it's a Boeing, I ain't going.
Members of the Senate Commerce Committee grilled FAA head Michael Whitaker on Thursday over his oversight of Boeing's safety culture. This after high-profile crashes in recent years and the door blowing off a plane mid-flight in January.
We have added more safety inspectors at the Boeing and Spirit facilities to closely scrutinize and monitor production. Our enhanced oversight activities include more direct engagement of company employees.
Whitaker said he also made Boeing come up with a plan to improve safety. Senator Amy Klobuchar pointed out one problem.
Legions of senior machinists retired when the pandemic hit.
Whitaker said they also didn't transfer their knowledge before they retired.
What we're encouraging operators in the system to do is recognize that as a risk and build programs around that to mitigate that risk, which means more training, more mentoring, and more time to complete tasks.
Ranking member Senator Ted Cruz asked why all key records regarding the MAX 9 aircraft with the blown off door are missing.
The security camera footage was overwritten. Boeing doesn't know who performed work on the door plug, and no paperwork exists. Is that all right?
Whitaker said it's too early to have an opinion.
That investigation is ongoing.
Whitaker said he was unaware whether Boeing's unions were involved in safety discussions.
Unions were not significantly involved in developing the plan.
Senator Ed Markey said he has evidence that Boeing is very hostile to unions, which he said contributes to the poor safety culture.
It encourages managers to limit interactions between union and non-union employees. And it even has a map that shows Boeing's concerted efforts to move critical Boeing safety functions away from the union stronghold in Everett.
Whitaker said that Boeing reaches out to its employees directly.
And now for your sports news, we're joined by NTD's Dave Martin over at the Sports Hub. Dave, plenty going on today, but let's start in the NFL, where the Atlanta Falcons were punished for violating the league's anti-tampering policies in the signing of free agent quarterback Kirk Cousins. Now, how serious was this violation?
You know, as tampering violations go, this actually wasn't that big. You know, the new NFL season starts every March, and at that point, teams can talk to player agents for the first 48 hours, but not to actually, you know, player free agents at this time. Now, that includes for travel arrangements or other logistical matters, which would be common if you were bringing in a player for a visit. Now, apparently, that's what this violation was for. So they were docked a fifth-round pick and fined. Now, comparatively, that's not bad. You know, not all these cases are equal. Last year, the Miami Dolphins were docked a first-round pick and a third-round pick for tampering with Tom Brady and Sean Payton in really one of the more severe instances. So at least in this case, the Atlanta Falcons got their guy, signing Cousins to a four-year contract.
Moving to golf news, today is the opening round of the U.S. Open. Tiger Woods played today, but has struggled. Where did he finish?
Yeah, he's finished somewhere in the low 100s. Now, this is out of 156 players. He shot a 4 over 74. That puts him 9 shots off the leader. You know, he started off well, had a birdie in his first hole. He had a number of pars. It was really on the back nine that he struggled. He had 4 bogeys and a birdie there. So he's 9 strokes behind the leader. That's Patrick Cantlay. Now, Woods has won this event 3 times in his career, but he's got to rally tomorrow just to make the weekend cut. I mean, that's the top 60 players. Now, some other players of note here. Rory McIlroy ranked 2nd in the world. He was at 3 under through 15 holes, 1 shot behind the leader. Now, Rory has won 2 majors, but not this one. Phil Mickelson, meanwhile, shot a 9-79. That puts him at next to last. Mickelson has won every major except for the U.S. Open. He's actually finished runner-up here 6 times, so he's going to have to really rally tomorrow if he's going to make the weekend cut.
Shifting gears to the NBA Finals, Boston defeated Dallas last night to take a 3-0 lead. What are the Mavericks' chances at coming back?
I mean, pretty low. I mean, essentially, they're trapped. No team has ever done this in the history of the NBA before. You know, the Mavericks would really have to make history. Of the previous 156 teams to fall behind 0-3 in a series, only one even rallied to tie the series at 3. That was the Boston Celtics, actually, last year against the Miami Heat. Unfortunately for the Celtics, they lost Game 7 and had to watch the Heat go to the NBA Finals instead of them. Now, if the Mavericks are going to do this, they're certainly going to need a similar effort that they got from Kyrie Irving last night, who struggled in Games 1 and 2. Irving, though, scored 35 points. That was a game high, and he hit roughly half his shot. He played very well. Now, let's take a look at the Mavericks' updated shot attempts chart through 3 games of the series. As you can see, are very top-heavy. You got Luka Doncic, who is the league's top scorer, and Kyrie Irving taking 56% of their shots. It's no secret that they are top heavy. It's by design that way. Unfortunately, it kind of backfired last night. Doncic fouled out of the game with 4 minutes to go. It was a very close game at that time, and the Dallas Mavericks were not able to win. So meanwhile, Boston, though, they played last night without Kristaps Porzingis. Now, we've talked about the Celtics' balance, especially on offense here. Now, Jason Tatum, this is actually taking a quarter of their shots. You got Jaylen Brown, Drew Holiday, and Derek White here. This is a very balanced offense. Basically, whoever is open is shooting the ball. It's a very pretty offense, actually, to watch. This much balance is why they're so hard to beat, even without Kristaps Porzingis. Now, Porzingis' availability going forward is kind of unknown. He's listed as day-to-day. In any case, Game 4 will be tomorrow night in Dallas.
Looking at the NHL Stanley Cup Finals, tonight is Game 3 between Edmonton and Florida. The Oilers themselves are in trouble of trailing 3-0 if they lose tonight. What do they need to win?
You know, they just need to score. I mean, they've only got 1 goal in the 2 games thus far. A lot of that is because their power play has been really shut down by Florida's penalty kill. They've had 7 power play opportunities through 2 games. They are 0-7. Up to this point in the playoffs, they were 19 out of 51. That's 37% of their power plays they got a goal out of. Now, in Game 1, it wasn't so awful. They were 0-3 on the power play. They got 6 shots on goal. But Game 2, they got 4 power play opportunities, only 1 shot on goal the entire time. Now, some of that certainly can be attributed to Florida goalie Sergei Bobrovsky. He stopped 50 out of 51 shots in the series. That's like 95%. That is excellent for a goalie. Now, tonight is Game 3. It's going to be in Edmonton, so I would expect the Oilers to come out with a lot more energy. That game is going to start at 8 p.m.
Well, Dave, as always, thanks for joining us.
Well, thank you, Tiff.
And that's all for today's news. For around-the-clock coverage, visit us at ntd.com or download our NTD app. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Tiffany Meyer. Good night.